again and welcome to another episode of Voices from SA. My name is Nicholas Claude. Nice to be with you again. Sorry for the delay. Just some crazy things going on. Actually, was diagnosed with coronavirus a few weeks ago. Been quarantining. So just a little bit of a mental setback. Asymptomatic, so feeling fine. My name is Nicholas Claude. I hope you are keeping well, keeping safe, keeping healthy. Remember to wash your hands regularly, wear a face mask in public, observe social distancing, and remain quarantined as much as possible. My guest this week is Hwapi Kabe. She is a cinematographer, the director of photography. When you see the credits roll, the person behind the camera. I'm interested in film, photography, and the related areas of filmmaking. My brother works in post-production in London. So we had a good chat, not only about her journey, the path into being a cinematographer, but some of the technical aspects of filmmaking as well. So we spoke, for instance, about the role of the cinematographer in interpreting a director's vision, how she works with directors, and sometimes with actors, and her whole planning process, how she kind of envisages the film unfolding as she reads the script. We also spoke a little about some of the technical aspects, lighting, framing, the technology of film these days, cameras and lenses as well. She loves technology, and we had a good chat about those aspects as well. So please now enjoy my chat with Hwapi.
Hwapi, thanks very much for your time today. I've been tracking you for some months. We've been in contact back and forth for a couple of months now, and I'm glad we finally have now found the time, despite the fact that you're in Cape Town. It's amazing, actually, how used we are now to just talking to people wherever they are, via whatever remote audio software we have at our disposal, or video calls or whatever, isn't it? I mean, it's just how it's become this kind of natural way of communicating now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, it has become remote everything, which is quite interesting, because that's the one thing, I guess, I'm taking away from COVID. Like, in the past, like, meetings were, like, we used to meet and drive out to different places, like 20-minute drive to go meet a person that I feel like sometimes maybe this kind of communication is not too bad. You know, I think it's got its place, and it's going to be more encouraged going forward. Like, some meetings in the past, I've felt like, I cannot believe that I just drove about 45 minutes to tell me something that could have been 10 minutes on the phone. So from a productive point of view, this is, to me, a new kind of deal, because the only time that I did these kind of calls was if I'm speaking to somebody overseas, family, or like overseas meeting. But for people locally, I wasn't using it much as a platform. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I was actually talking to a friend of mine's kid this morning. I think he must be 12, 13, 14, and I was just asking how it's going, because, obviously doing a lot of remote learning, but he was very frustrated. He didn't dig it.
Oh, shame. But it must be
frustrating. Say again?
I'm saying it must be so frustrating for the little ones with school.
Yeah, you're missing their mates more than anything, I suppose. Said you've been doing. I mean, have you been doing? How have you been? Because you're a DOP, a cinematographer. You've been. I mean, the whole global film production, video production industry has essentially been closed for the last couple of months. What have you been doing to amuse yourself in the meantime?
in a very weird way. So I'm in Cape Town because I'm shooting the third Netflix Africa original. I think we've shot about 2 episodes and we've got 4 more to go. So when this whole thing happened and the lockdown was been spoken about, the production immediately were like, okay, cool, let's put the project on pause for now, right? But I had been working since last November before that, so I feel like I'd been working for the last year and a half without a break. Like back-to-back project with like 2 weeks in between. When this happened, at the beginning, obviously, because we were in production and we just picked up momentum and we're finding our flow, you know, as the team, I was quite
frustrated.
I'm annoyed, yeah, but I guess I was frustrated, but understanding the whole, you know, the bigger picture about the pandemic, that it's not just us, it's not just a project, it's a global thing, and it's like not just the chosen ones, like it's happening to everyone. Have to be understanding, you know. So when it happened, I was like, okay, I guess this is gonna be unforced leave, you know.
Yeah.
And so I went in with that, maybe it's a blessing in disguise, because I've been at it, you know, and I'm also approaching a burnout because back-to-back, working back-to-back like that is not good for anyone.
No, sure.
So then immediately I made it like a positive thing. I was like, okay, this is going to be great. It's not a holiday, but it's rest. So come up with a little list for myself of things that I've been wanting to do that I don't have a chance to do when I'm working.
Right.
You know, let me try and tackle that first, because here you are, you've got a break. You know, now you can read the books that you've been putting off. Now you can do the things, watch all those films that you've been wanting to.
Yeah.
And generally just get some rest. So my approach is just, I started taking it easy. I went to the point of even calling it a fake holiday. But also this is at the beginning, so you not knowing how long this is going to last. You know, like I think from mid, that was like mid-March. You know, second week of March.
Yeah.
So I didn't think this far. I didn't think that I'd be sitting here at the beginning of June. So the first month and a half at least, I just took everything easy. Like I relaxed as much as I can. I slept in, waking up late, which is a luxury. If I got out of for midday, would be a miracle. Like I've been proper sleeping, but then creating a new pattern and a new cycle of going to bed extremely late, you know, watching things and reading and just being, but created a new pattern. So that's what's been up. That's what I've been doing.
Yeah, we've been watching a lot of movies as well, funnily enough. It's become a little ritual for my wife and I, and exercising, which we didn't, well, I certainly didn't used to do, exercising every morning and baking lots of things. It is a surreal sort of existence right now. Even, you know, we allowed out for our little morning gaps and allowed to go to shops and that. It's, I don't know, I'm still sort of getting my head around the whole thing. Are you from Cape Town originally?
No. I'm from Johannesburg. I'm from Soweto.
Okay.
I was born in Soweto. I'm here. I'm up and down in Cape Town for work.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, we'll get a little bit into that. I mean, Cape Town, I suppose, is seen as this kind of center of many film, TV, advertising productions, isn't it?
Yes.
So, Can you tell me a little bit about your, I mean, being a cinematographer, a woman cinematographer, I was actually online, you see these lists of like top 10, there's very few women cinematographers in the world. It is quite a niche profession within the industry itself, being a, do I use the term cinematographer or DOP? How do you describe, is there a difference?
No, both. So, yeah, the one is the job and the other one is the person. So I don't mind.
Oh, okay. All right. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you got into film? I mean, did you watch a lot, did your parents watch a lot of films at home, or how did you kind of get sucked into this crazy world?
I guess my story is not a typical story, you know. Being born in the 80s, growing up in the 90s in Soweto, with a very traditional family, like my mom is old school, you know, she's a teacher.
What does that mean, old school?
She's old school, she's very traditional. So I wouldn't say, I mean, I didn't grow up with cinema or the art world being a thing,
right.
You know, like we never had a culture of going to movies or watching films together. You know, it would be like the normal watching the local, I mean, the normal soapies or dramas that are currently playing. But I didn't grow up with the cinema and the arts, like the art world being part of my, you know, growing up. So I'd say I picked it up a little bit later, when I was in high school.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. So I think when I was in the 11th grade, I mean, I wanted to become an engineer, you know.
Okay.
My math, I had really good math and science marks. So I was veering into engineering and that kind of field. This is what I thought, at least when I was in grade 7 and grade 8. I mean, grade 10. And then I think around the 11th grade, there was a little chapter about film studies. You know, it was even brought in later on. Like, you know, I think the kids now study film studies in early on, you know. So a little introduction in the English class. There's a little chapter about the film and the film industry and what it is. So I think that was the first, oh wow, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, first highlight. And then I had a teacher called Lulu Fenta who had been in the industry and she's a teacher, took a break to get into the industry, and she was in production for quite a while and then came back to teaching. And she was very interested in finding talented kids in my school to take them to auditions, you know, just expose us to the arts world. She was an art teacher, an English and arts teacher. So she took us to the Fat Joe Show. There used to be the show called the Fat Joe Show.
Right.
It was a live show and they needed an audience. And she did it as a field trip for the grade 11s and grade 12s. And I was lucky to be part of the crew that went, you know?
Yeah.
We sat there, I mean, the studios were in Melville, in Melville. I remember just getting there and being just like amazed. Just like, wow, what is this world, you know?
All the lights, all the bright lights and the cameras. And
Yes, it was exactly that, you know. I was 15, like, it just seemed wow to me. Everything was wow. And then I began, that was the real proper moment that I remember, you know, that made me go, I want to know more. I want to learn more about what the arts and film and television, what it could be about. Maybe I'm not meant to be a scientist. Maybe science is not my thing after all. So then that was the beginning of it, you know, and later on she introduced us to, like, my best friend became a kiddie show presenter on Crazy. So I'd go to the studios quite often to go visit, you know. And I think by the end of grade 11, I had changed my major to, like, having applied to become a mechanical engineer.
Sure.
Rewind. I really want to know what film is about, and you know, and also picking it up so late. I think I did it. It feels like a disservice to myself, but I applied. It was too late. I applied at the schools that had already taken in their applications, but I just went on with it. You know, my mother and my sister couldn't believe it. They were just like, "You are crazy."
Yeah, I was going to say, what did your mum say? She had this vision of you. I mean, I think a lot. I read a lot of or listen to a lot of interviews with people who've gone into film or the arts or acting or drama or on both sides of the camera, I suppose. And like the parents' reaction most of the time is one of horror and complete disbelief.
Yeah, she was completely shook. My sister didn't help, you know. My sister's about 10 years older than me. And she was like, sort of like the first generation of the multiracial school, you know, gang, you know. So she didn't have it easy.
Right, yeah, you know, I had up in a kind of different era in a way, I suppose. She's 10 years.
In a way.
10 years in that sort of 1980s, 1990s South Africa is a kind of different world, man.
A shame, right? So she couldn't believe it. So, you know, growing up in that time, she thought that I'd have the better. She looks at it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I've had the better education.
You're wasting your chance now.
Yeah. She like looked at my marks. She's like, dude, I don't understand. You did so well in maths and you do so well in science. Why would you go into the arts? You know, media. No. Why don't you do IT? Like, IT was a big thing when I was in matric.
Right.
Like, everybody wanted to do information science or become an accountant or mechanical engineer, which is the thing that I was going to do, you know, anything in engineering. But without doing the right research, like, some of the people that I was in school with are currently unemployed because they went with the more traditional careers, you know? But it's all, I guess, miseducation and people not having a lot of information regarding certain
career
industries.
Paths. So yeah.
My sister was like, "You're gonna pay your own school fees. that's because you're gonna become jobless and you're never ever gonna have a job." You know, those kind of things.
Yeah.
But I was very stubborn about it. I was like, you know, this feels right. This feels like this is where I need to be.
And it was the camera that you wanted to be behind? Or did you just want to get into it somehow, into that industry?
You know, it starts off with the idea of being in front of the TV, especially because my two best friends were both presenters, you know, on a kiddie show. And the idea started off, oh, you know, it would be really nice to be part of, like, in front of the camera. But you go to these auditions and then you realize very soon that you're not one for in front of the camera. I start to, you know, like, all my things come out. So I was like, okay, forget that dream. That's not for you.
Yeah.
Let the ones meant to be in front of the camera do their thing.
Yeah.
And then be behind the camera started. So that's when I was like, okay, directing seemed like fun. You know, I thought directing seemed like fun.
It's funny how the camera can be quite intimidating to people. You put a camera in front of somebody and they kind of just, their brain kind of switches somehow. So it does, it is a certain particular skill, certainly, to stand in front of a camera, whether you're an actor or a presenter or a reporter, I would say.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, years later, I'm the one that shoves my camera onto people's faces, you know? And as soon as the wheels turn and the camera is facing me, oh, my word.
Not so powerful after all.
Not so powerful. Everybody always asks me when I go to interviews, like, "You, dude, be the one that is normally, like, how can you be so shy?" Or it's like another person takes over.
Yeah.
Weird.
If I can just speak a little. For me, as I understand it, you're dealing with a couple of things. You're dealing with, and we can discuss them in turn. You know, there's the relationship you have with the director in terms of interpreting the director's vision. You have the script as well, which might be from a different source, and the director's trying to sort of interpret the script. So you're a kind of triangle, as I imagine it, to what ends up on the screen, whether it be a film or an ad or a TV show. Is that a correct sort of understanding? Is that how you see your role in a way?
So the way that I see my role is I'm there to ensure that the director's vision comes to life, right? But at the same time, taking the script and interpreting it in a manner and a form that I, as a filmmaker, feel like it represents who I am, you know, through my lighting and camera work and style. And just to also, like, I think my job is to make sure that the story being told is kept authentic, you know, authentic to what the script is, you know, to the script writers, and authentic to the director, and authentic to the viewer, the people that will be receiving it. By authentic, I mean the delivery of the story. Am I through my visuals, am I in the best position to tell this story for what it is?
It's about look and feel then, in terms of what the director has kind of tried to convey to you, and it's look and feel in terms of what the script has been saying to you as well.
Yes, that's precisely it. That is precisely it.
How do then, if I can speak about, say, film and TV in particular, how do you go about, like, choosing the projects that you get involved in? Are you attracted to a director, or are you attracted to a script? Or is it something, was it just like, I need to do some work now, and let's get on set? In an ideal situation, I suppose.
I think I look at myself as a young and upcoming cinematographer, right? Like I feel like I have done my hours, in the sense of how I became a cinematographer, and I've been deeping for less than 10 years, I would say. So in that regard, I consider myself somebody that's growing in the industry, and as a filmmaker and as a storyteller. So for most of the projects that I've done, I haven't had the luxury to be able to select and be like, oh no, you know, this director is not great, or the script is not great.
Yeah.
But I have been fortunate enough to work with really cool people, like really good directors that have found me, and we've built a journey or relationship.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm slowly, you know, getting to that point where in the future, I think my approach will be about story, you know. To be able to select the kind of narrative that I want to be involved with and tell.
Yeah.
Is becoming more and more important to me, you know.
That's interesting.
I think with directors, choosing directors, it's a bit of a tricky thing, you know. Yeah. Because sometimes you get along with people on a general get along as humans, and then when you get to the work part of it, you find that you're completely different, you know. So I really hope and pray that I get to work with like a lot more, like the directors that I've been working with so far in my career are also friends.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So, and with same interest at heart of telling really good stories.
Yes.
And narrative. And I really pray and hope that even in the future, I will be working with directors that will have the same mentality, same goals and objectives and interest in story, you know? I think the kind of directors that I wouldn't want to work with are people that I would have anything in common with, you know, people that, I think that would probably be the only reason that I would be like, nah, I'm not too keen on working with you as a director, you know? I think, for now.
I was just, I did, in preparation for our discussion, I listened or watched a couple of interviews with Roger Deakins, and, you know, he was talking about, he's done, and I was just thinking, you know, there seems to be often, I think Steven Spielberg, you know, he has his guy, and, well, Deakins, he's worked with the Coen brothers quite a lot, and he was talking about their relationship pretty much how you've said that, you know, that he you know, not that they hang out together, but they're friends, they've got a kind of a human connection that they can then sort of build on when they're in a production. And of course, you know, every film is different, but there's that common kind of just sense, I suppose, of the vision of the view of the world, etc.
Yes, that's it.
The other component, as I see it, with you, or the role of the DP, or is it, and where your imagination is kind of given the space to operate, is in that choice between sort of framing or image, if I can put it that way, and lighting.
Yes.
Yeah, just if you could just tell me how you make those choices of light and framing.
Okay, great. So I'll start with lighting, because lighting to me is what cinematography is about. You know, it's being able to use light to create and tell a story, like create a mood. You know, it's in your lighting. So you get your script, right, and you read the scene, and this scene is about being happy, you know. So me, my job is to use my imagination and my creativity to create that feel, so that when the viewer is watching, you know, they're watching and they can get that feeling. So when they're watching this picture, this moving picture, the feeling that they get is, this is a happy image, you know. So I look at lighting, I read, when I read the script, I start envisioning the feeling that, like, as I'm reading, the feeling that I'm getting is the feeling that I try and emulate with my life, you know?
Right. So, I mean, as you're reading a script, you're almost seeing or considering possibilities already very early on.
Yes. So when I receive a script normally, I read it the first time just so that I read it, like a normal person that would read a book, you know. But even when you're reading a book, you know, if your mind takes you there, you already envision it as you're reading. But the first time around, I just try and read just for reading, you know. And then the second time around, I pause, I stop, and I pick the sense up, or I would jot down a note of how the scene is making me feel, you know? If it's moody, if it's cloudy, if it's dark, if it's a silhouette kind of an image, you know? So as I'm reading, as soon as I get images that come through, then I start jotting them down. And later on, after I've spoken to the director on what they'd like to achieve with the scene, you know, I start designing and using my imagination to try and capture that moment, like that feel, you know, yeah.
Have an influence then over the kind of shooting schedule, if you kind of imagine what light you need for the shot that would be a certain time of day? Can you do you have an input on that, or are you then kind of forced to maybe use unnatural light for certain moments that you perhaps would prefer to use natural light?
The relationship between the DOP and the first AD or whoever's doing the schedule is very tricky, you know? Yeah, that's why I like to keep the first ADs on my side and friends, because the DOP does influence the schedule a lot, you know?
Yeah.
Like it would be, let's say, the actor's availability first that would influence the schedule, and second on that list, it would be the DOP.
That's good.
Because, if you know, all these locations will provide you with everything different, and if you envision the scene to be happening in a moodier feel, and the sun happens to be out, I'm also known for being very fussy about that. You know, I refuse. I'm like, you know, when we created this scene and when we spoke about this is all in prep, you know, like we spoke about scheduling it on a day like this, in shade, in cloud, in, you know, not so much light. So there's always a plan to try and make it happen. You know, unless if it's a sunny day, you can't do anything much about a sunny day or when it's raining. That's God control, you know. You let God do his thing. So that there's nothing much I can do about. But production would then normally try and convince you to try and create that look, you know? So you go, that's fine. You can create the look. But just note that X, Y, and Z would happen. You know, these, we have to pull in these factors. We'll need two more persons to help to do this. We'll need X, right. Y, amount of time, you know, so we need 2-3 more hours
to reset the light, or to reset the lighting is going to take this amount of time, and that's just how it's going to have to be.
Yes, so then because they're the money people, and then they would be sitting there going, okay, cool, does it make sense for us to schedule this particular scene on this day when we already have everything that's needed, you know? If it's a cloudy day, should we schedule it on a cloudy day so we can get more out of the production, more production value? Or do we do it on a day when it's not great and spend the amount of time trying to block off the sun or trying to create the same mood and lose about 2 hours in the day? It's normally a battle. It's normally a big battle. It's not like Hollywood or Roger Dickens in 1917 where they had to shoot everything in cloud, you know, because this whole movie is happening in one day, and it cannot have continuity. So they took the days when it was sunny, they didn't shoot anything. They just rehearsed.
Yeah.
And just rehearsed their moves. So they Hollywood style, one day I'll get there. At the moment, is for now, it's just back and forth with production, back and forth until finding a compromise, you know. Yeah, that there's just times when you cannot, there is absolutely nothing. You cannot move. You are stuck. You can wait around for 2 hours, wait out for the rain and see what the iPhone weather or IQ weather is saying. Yeah, it does get tricky.
I want to go back a little bit. You know, we spoke about that, don't fix it in post-production, your quote. How important is sort of planning and pre-production? Is there enough time and budget for that in local productions? It sounds like a necessity, but I suppose it's kind of seen as a luxury in a way.
So in local projects and productions, I don't think they look at it as if it's a luxury. I think any producer that knows what they're doing will does understand the necessity of prep you know, but because they also binded by the lack of budget, you know, and they need to also make money as a production. So they will cut what they can. The sad part is when they cut out a lot of the prep, you know, and try and make it up during the production and filming, because I think a lot of the stuff...
Well, that's kind of what I'm asking. I'm just like, where do you get the... If the budget's going to be cut, I mean, do you find that it mainly is then in pre-production that you feel the pain?
Yes, it is in the local industry. It is in prep that they cut the budget, and that is to me, and in every production that I've worked on locally, it's always the biggest mistake.
It just seems to be exactly like a miss. A wrong approach in a way, you know, that whatever time and money you devote for pre-production is going to be probably the best spent money.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. Like having been working, so, you know, I feel like it's so great. I'm so blessed to be able to work on the international project and local projects, you know. Because now I've got a taste of both worlds, and I know how it's done in the internationals. You know, they take time in prep. Yeah. And a lot of the problems are solved in prep. Exactly. Because it's during prep where you can see problems from a mile. You go, okay, that has a potential of being a problem. Yeah. How do we get around? How do we solve that? That is also a problem. That could potentially be a solution. And everything gets sorted out pretty much in prep. And by the time you arrive on set to film, it's smooth. There'll always be problems. You know, like, don't get me wrong. There'll always be challenges, like, in everything. But a lot of major things can be avoided or can be even picked up during the prep time. You know, whether it's a thing in the script that's inconsistent, whether it's logistics in terms of planning and scheduling, you know, all those elements, if they're done well and in prep, in time, like by the time you get to shooting, it's smooth sailing. Sailing as smooth sailing can be.
Yeah. No, of course, I get that. I've had mates who've produced things, and I've managed to wangle myself onto set as an extra in one or two things. And just watching that whole, I mean, it is a time-consuming damn process, isn't it? A day on set.
Yeah.
However much planning you've done.
Yes, it is. It is. It is a very time-consuming process. It's hurry up and wait.
And I suppose, despite all the pre-planning you've done, there will, as you say, always something else will crop up, and it's then you become a very important component of solving whatever issue, particularly if it's a sort of a camera, a shot issue, right?
Yeah. The one thing that I'm learning project to project is that I can never have plan A only.
Yeah.
Like that has become part of my my go-to notes.
Yeah. You know? Always another one or two options beyond what's on the page.
Absolutely. Always try and have two more plans. Huh. Two more way out, two more solutions to getting or figuring out the scene and telling the story, you know? Because a lot of the times what you've planned, and you've planned it to the T in prep, and something little, or that could seem little, can just blow out your entire plan. Your entire work for weeks can be down the... But the bigger thing for me has been to have a plan B, and sometimes even a plan C,
yeah,
where possible. you know, so that when something like that does happen, then we can go, okay, great, this is not a great thing that's happening, but why don't we try to do it this way? Shall we maybe modify this, and let's try go this route?
Yeah.
And that's when that's where I come in. Yeah, that would be my approach.
Oh, it's just, yeah, it's amazing, eh? Can I ask you a little bit about, I mean, you want to be, I suppose, I don't know, you can respond once I've asked this, or respond once I've said this. You want to be recognized as a professional in your field, but you don't want to be typecast, do you? I mean, you don't want to, no film, no project that you work on should be like people will be able to name you in that because it looks the same.
No, I wouldn't want to be, like you said, typecast. I think most cinematographers have a signature, but I wouldn't want to have one style of filming because I feel like that wouldn't be true to the projects that I'd be taking up because they're all so different, you know? They're all so different. Like, my current project is about a story about a girl from KZN who's a dancer. It's about dancing, you know, it's a dance show.
Yeah.
The show that I shot before this is about females in prison, like a female prison drama series, which is a lot dark, and the world is completely different.
Grim world, yeah.
Yeah, so when you look at the two, in terms of camera work, and I hope that nobody will be able to say, this is the same person that shot this.
Are they just kind of nice little touches that you like to add just to, for yourself, in a way?
Yes, I do. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of handheld.
Uh-huh.
Of operating the camera myself and doing it and just holding it, just putting it on my shoulder.
Right.
And
not steady cam, but kind of on your in your arms.
In my arms and just feeling it and with that eyepiece to the eye, you know, and going with the story. And you know, like, my focus pullers always complain when I'm doing handheld shots because I always go the extra mile, you know.
You're meant to stop there.
Pardon?
Yeah, so they're shouting at you, there's your mark.
Yes, they go, but that's your mark, you know, like, but I'm like, hey, your job is to remain sharp, eh? your job is to be sharp. My job is to capture the moment. So when I'm handheld and looking through the eyepiece, I can connect with the actors. You know, there's no feeling greater than that, you know, being able to see and feel emotions through the eyepiece in the moment. That for me is my favorite shooting. Like, if one day they say Gaupie is a signature, I would hope that would be my signature, you know, because the framing, it depends on what the story is in that moment. You find your beautiful spot and you content and everything just feels like it falls together. Yeah, but I like all sorts of shots, you know. I'm a big fan of landscape. I'm a big fan of big wide shots.
Yeah, but as you,
too.
Yeah, whatever, yeah, whatever kind of fits the mood, I suppose, as you say.
Yes, absolutely. Whatever fits the narrative,
yeah,
you know, and whatever motivates it better or tells the story better. But I'm a fan of most things when it comes to cinematography.
But you raised now that something that I hadn't really considered is your relationship with the actors. I mean, do you speak to them ever yourself?
You know, it's funny, because this is one of the things that I'm learning to become better at. You know, at the beginning, I when I started shooting, I never liked to talk a lot with the actors, and I preferred the director or the first AD to do the communication with the actors. You know, if it's needing them to do certain things or move in a little bit or just go a little bit right, a little bit left. At the beginning, I would just leave it to the first AD and the director. But growing, you know, and shooting more, and especially with projects that I like, you know, you build a relationship with actors. You know, you learn to build a relationship with actors, because they need to trust you. You know,
right?
And yes, they need to,
how they are going to look is up to you.
Yes, they need to have complete trust and be comfortable with the person that's behind the camera, you know, that they capturing them and in their truest form and showing them in good light, so to say. So I have learned and appreciate the relationships that I create with a different talent on set. I've learned that sometimes it's better off coming from the DP's mouth, you know, if it's
right,
needing them to hit a certain mark. Because sometimes actors don't understand why they would need to be in that position. And I try and communicate these things without affecting performance, you know. If it starts to feel like it's affecting too much with the performance, I let it go. I'd rather move the light than have to move the actor.
Right.
You know? Or pan a little bit left, or change my shot a little bit, just to make them be comfortable. Especially, it also depends on what kind of scene it is. You know, if it's an easy enough scene, just light and easy going, and establish the relationship with the actor, I'd be like, you know, if you come in just a few inches forward, you'll be in the sweet spot for light. Or if you go back a little bit, then you are in the great place for the background. Nothing is going out of your head. Some actors appreciate it. You know, but then it's all in the learning process. You figure it out after the first week of shooting. You know, some right. actors don't want to be told. You don't want to be approached by DP.
Yeah, the lowly DP, yeah.
Yeah, they like VIP, like no, like they'd rather be get direction from the directing team.
Yeah, I can imagine it must get a little bit, you have to be sensitive.
You have to be sensitive, yeah. I think with every project stepping on, you have to be sensitive to the talent, you know. Find your mojo, find your space, find a relation, and when it happens, and it's great, when it happens, it can be beautiful. Because it's like connection, it's like dancing, yeah. it's a beautiful synergy, you know? And when it doesn't work, it can also be really whack.
I just want to speak a little bit about cameras and just film technology. You say, like, you started in this 10 years ago. I'm just thinking that was sort of, did you ever work with film when you were training, or was it like, I'm just thinking, was it 1080, like 1080 HD kind of was the big main thing back then? I'm just thinking how the world has moved to 4K, 8K. I mean, it's where does it end?
It's at 8K for the moment.
You know?
Yeah. So I started, it was 2003. To the end of 2003, this is when I, you know, started going as a, like, attending, coming to sit as a trainee. 2004, I'm one of the very few lucky, like, young DOPs or young filmmakers that got to do the film thing.
Huh.
You know, I didn't shoot on film, unfortunately,
okay.
You know, and because I didn't go to a traditional film school. We never shot on film, but I did load on film.
Okay.
So I trained to load on film, and I was a dark room loader, and I was an on set loader for about, I'd say a year. This was towards the end of film. I started at the end of film, and coming in was HD.
Yes.
This was at the beginning phase of HD. So yeah, it was great. It was different, eh? It was very different than
again, going back to Deacons, you know, he's saying like how he loves working with digital film now, because it's just so it's so immediate. You know, he was thinking back to the days where you'll send the can off to the laboratory, and you're just wondering, geez, I hope that, you know, let's have a look. I hope tomorrow morning when it comes back, it's looking okay, you know?
Yeah.
It's quite an amazing thing to think about, really.
It is crazy. It is crazy. I mean, the even just the discipline of filming something on or shooting something on film versus like HD or cassette or tape or whatever, you know, as a loader, the pressures of loading film and making sure that it's the correct film stock, you know, and making sure that there's never hairs in the gate, yeah. Making sure that everything is, and you only know this like the next day.
Eesh.
Once it's or 2-3 days, you know. So the pressure of going home and being a loader was not great. Like,
really?
Being a loader then, okay, was great for the discipline side of things, but the amount of pressure was just hectic, because it's the responsibility of the entire production that's on your shoulders.
Sure, I didn't, you know, realize that. Yeah.
But here you are sitting with a mag that's full. And it's today's rushes.
Yeah.
You know, it's your job to unload that mag, and it has to go smooth. You have to make sure that it's not exposed. You have to make sure that everything, the process goes smooth. It's labeled correctly by the time it hits the lab.
Yeah.
So it's your responsibility, and then you get to drive it as well. You get to drive. All the way to Sasani Studios to my word. But
did you ever have a bad day?
No.
Okay.
No, I've also worked under, like, you know, the focus pullers of then, the focus pullers then were like army trained. They ran the film industry like, you know, they ran the camera department, rather, let me say. They would run the camera department like an army.
Like a military, you know, operation.
Absolutely, you know. Uh-huh. but it was necessary. It was, yeah. Because you cannot afford to make a mistake. You cannot afford to fuck up.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you know, maybe I wouldn't be in the industry anymore, because nobody has... They'd also take you out, take your name out, you know,
yeah,
like.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think that's the fortunate part. Even though they ran it like military style, they made sure that everybody is on point 100% all the time.
Do you have a favorite camera that you like to work with? I was just looking at those Arri Alexas. Do you, or the Reds? I mean, there's been a lot of, it seems that cameras have got kind of just more nimble and more capable over just in a very short time.
Yeah, technology is an amazing thing. I mean, when I think about where HD started to where we are now, like you're saying, it's been like, it's very, very quick. Very short space, and the development is insane. Like, my favorite camera at the moment is the Arri Mini.
Arri Mini, yeah.
So the Arri Alexa Mini. So yeah. they've done a large format iteration of it, which is also I haven't had the chance to shoot on it yet, but I've done a few tests. So between the Arri Mini and the Sony Venus. Those are currently my favorite cameras.
And what do you kind of look for in a camera then, for yourself?
So I look at different things. I look at the physicalness of it, how it looks and how it feels is very important to me. You know, I mean, there's the technical side of things, like does it have, is it low light? Does it have built-in NDs?
What is NDs?
Like neutral density filters.
Okay.
So they just help you to put it in a stop. But the physical look and feel of a camera is very important to me.
Right.
You know,
just the weight, like, the weight, how it feels in your hand. I suppose shooting a lot handheld, you need something that you can carry, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's not really the weight. You know, I'm finding that the heavier the camera, the better the operation.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like the Arri Amira. I have shot most of my projects on the Arri Amira because it's a hand, it was built for handheld.
Right.
You know, it doesn't have a few features like being like that the Mini have, like to shoot anamorphics and to, yeah, but the feel of it is great.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're comparing the Arri Mini to the Red, for me the Red is very impractical to use. Like right. it's not my favorite camera to use. It's the way that it's designed, it's not really great for handheld. I even with the cleverest focus puller and grip assistance or whatever, they can help find a way that it could be comfortable. But I always find my way, like myself going, oh my word, I hate this camera. But so, with the Amira, you know, you just put it on the shoulder, you put the lens on, and you can go immediately.
Off you go.
So the practicality of it is great. But I look at the sensor, I look at the latitude of the camera, you know, what it can give you, the sensor size.
Right.
You know, like now, and we can shoot full sensor up to 6K.
Yeah.
You know? Which is brilliant. It's great. So all those old lenses that were used for 70 mil, you know, can be used now.
Right.
So it's incredible. It's incredible.
And then, as you say, there are the lenses as well.
Yes, there's lenses as well. You know, that love lenses. Glass. Yeah, like even with glass, you know, it depends on the type of project and the type of story you're telling.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah, how a lens gives you the capacity to influence the feel.
Absolutely. The lens, I mean, lens technology has also, like camera technology, is improving every day, getting better and better every day, you know? So the choices are becoming more and more. So when you're doing a project, you can look at and compare five different types of lenses.
Yes.
That you want to tell the story, you know? I was going to say, my current project, I've chosen the Master Prime, Arri Master Primes, to shoot on this. And the reason to go with that is, like, it's a show that's young people. It's beautiful. It's glossy. It's, you know, and these master primes,
yeah,
like Roger Dickens, these are like Roger's favorite lenses.
Yeah.
You know, and I see why, like, well, what you can achieve with the, you know, it's got, they've got really good quality. And for me, when you're shooting portraits, it just captures like beauty. You know?
Yeah, that's lovely.
So yeah, so every project has the choice, and yeah, lenses, cameras.
I wonder, we're kind of running out of time now. I wanted to maybe talk about being a woman in film, but I kind of maybe don't want to now anymore.
This has been interesting, because that's normally the like one of the first few questions.
Yeah, and I just thought it's kind of a bit corny maybe, so I wanted to, you know, because you're just a cinematographer to me, you know what I mean?
Wow, I like that. I like that. I think it's maybe great that we don't go into detail or talk about it. But if I may, I would like to say something about it.
Sure.
Because for a very long time, I didn't want to be referred to as a female cinematographer or a woman DOP, you know.
Yeah.
Black female cinematography is the one that is used the most.
Mm.
And when I first started, I was very anti. I was anti being labeled like
typecast.
That. I was
just
like,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm a DOP. Let's leave it at that. And I think with like on a global stand, just the gender inequality in workplaces, you know, started being a real thing. For us here, the fact that people say I'm the only one, in the sense of being African, being a woman, and being a cinematographer, you know.
Yeah.
And then I started seeing a problem with not wanting to be called a female cinematographer, because I'm like, it has to be known. It has to be known that there's one of me, and it's not right, because how is it that
yes,
with an industry that's been, I mean, it's a young industry, but then I'm only 35 years old, you know, surely there should be somebody before me that was doing this, you know, that looks like me.
Mm.
But there isn't.
No.
You know, and then I started feeling like it's my duty to make sure that there will be more of me.
Right.
And the more I stand out and say, you know, every time I do like an interview or news or whatever, an article or whatever, and I'm like, visibility is key. You know, like,
yeah,
the more it's put on people's faces, the better.
Sure.
With that being said, yes, I'm a cinematographer. That's a woman. That's black. You know. And
yeah,
that's how I put it, you know? Not the other way around. I am a cinematographer, that's a woman, who happens to be a woman and who happens to be black. So that it doesn't feel like those things are more important than being a cinematographer.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for your time.
Cool, finally. I'm so happy that we were able to do this.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. I hope you did too.
No, I have. I have. I really enjoyed it. I'm pretty relaxed comparing to normal, so.
Well, you've had 2 months holiday, right?
Yes. We shall say that's the reason.
That's it. Okay, well.
I look forward to hearing this.
Cool stuff. Have a good weekend.
Okay, you too.
Cheers, Zach.
Cheers.
Bye.
She does have a wonderful laugh, and you can sort of just sense her bubbling. bubbly enthusiasm as we spoke. A great story, quite poignant when she mentioned her sister, you know, who's 10 years older than her and kind of grew up in the era of apartheid and sort of missed out on a lot of the opportunities that Kwapi was afforded just by that act of liberation in this country. Remember to sanitize, keep your distance, wear a mask. Thanks again to Hindenburg. Hindenburg software is designed for radio journalism and podcasting and is practical and easy to use. Go to hindenburg.com for more information. Sign up for a free trial. You may subscribe to Voices from SA via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Radio Public, Deezer, Audio Boom, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. Tell your colleagues, tell your friends, tell the world. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Claude. Cheers.